You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, half of dairy producers rely on immigrant workers. We take a look at Wisconsin's dairy industry and how it may already be changing under the Trump administration. First, terms like fake news, alternative facts, and post-truth became catchphrases in the 2016 election campaign and its aftermath, and fact-checking exploded as part of mainstream journalism. Our next guest is worried that we as a society are giving up on the idea of facts and truth and giving in to an ever-increasing flow of lies on social media and in our political system. He says we need to rebuild our critical thinking skills and get better at sorting out the truth from the lies. Daniel Levitin joins us now. He's a neuroscientist, dean of arts and humanities at the Minerva Schools at the Keck Graduate Schools, and a distinguished faculty fellow at the University of California, Berkeley. His newest book is called Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Daniel, you're not crazy about this idea of living in a post-truth world. You don't think we should accept it, but are we already there?
Well, no, I'm not willing to throw in the logical towel yet. I object to, you know, look, I think words matter, and I'm not just saying that because I'm a professor and it's my job. I mean, we've gone to war over words and misunderstandings, and a lot of hatred in this country is expressed through words. And when I hear somebody say use a term like fake news or alt truth or alternative facts, I think that it lowers the level of conversation, making it more stupid and making it harder for the rest of us to talk about reality.
Well, what should it be called?
Well, I wouldn't call let's take them one at a time. There is no such thing as alternative facts. A fact is something that exists in reality, and it's either true or it's not. There can be alternative views about what to do about a fact, right? We can agree what the facts are, but we might have different approaches as a society about how to deal with unemployment or climate change, just to pick two. The problem I have with the term fake news is that it sounds a little too benign.
Hmm.
I think that we should call it what it is. It's a lie. Fake news dignifies it as a variety or flavor of news, but it's not news at all.
So as a journalist, if someone is reporting the news, for instance, you write about the shooting at a D.C. pizza parlor that was targeted because someone had read an article that you would call a lie, saying that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex ring out of this pizza parlor, and then there was this shooting. So as a journalist, how would you report that? I think that might be where it gets a little sticky.
Well, you're a journalist. How would you want to handle something like that? Right? There are phases of it where at first you hear the story about Hillary Clinton running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor in suburban Washington, D.C., and maybe you read about it, but you're not willing to talk about it on Wisconsin Public Radio until you can get it confirmed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody were to ask you about it, what would you say?
Well, as a newscaster, though, I think that's where I'm not a newscaster, but to say the story, I guess you could just say the story was a lie.
Yeah, or you could say, you know, there's no evidence for the story. And then you could talk about how implausible it is. if you know anything about Hillary Clinton, you know that she gets these enormous speaking fees. She gets like $500,000 to give a talk. And, you know, she brought in millions and millions of dollars. Whether you're pro or anti-Hillary is not the issue. But, you know, resorting to an illegal activity in a child sex slave ring seems really far-fetched if you can just go out and talk for an hour.
And so what do you think has changed that we have all of these, you know, this proliferation of terms like that? We have fake news, we have fringe theories, and, you know, it used to be I was taught critical thinking in school, in grade school. Is that something that we've lost track of?
I think we have. I think two things have happened. The teaching of critical thinking somehow became, it seemed fusty or old-fashioned, and so we stopped doing it. And I think we should go back to it. We don't have to call it that. We could call it evidence-based thinking, if you like. But basically, going through a mental checklist, you know, like, is the claim plausible? Does it come from a good source? Are we hearing from an expert on the topic or only an amateur? These kinds of things, right? Is the data we're being presented even relevant to the issue? And I think the other problem is that in an effort to get along better in a multicultural society, we've adopted polite and delicate speech about a number of things, which I think is great. I'm not against that. But I think in an effort to avoid offending people, rather than calling it a lie, we call it fake news or alt-truth. And I say, if somebody's lying to you, go ahead and offend them.
We're talking with Daniel Levitin right now. He's a neuroscientist, and he's got a new book out. It's called Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. And he says, we're overcome right now with lies of one form or another. And he's got some advice about how to evaluate what we hear and what we read. And Daniel, let's get into some of those ways that we can evaluate different claims. You talk about, for instance, numbers, statistics. What should we think about before we just take them in and stamp them true and move on?
Well, the thing to remember about statistics and numbers is that they're not facts. They can represent facts, but in and of themselves, many of us are intimidated by them. There's an air of precision and accuracy to a number, but we have to ask ourselves some, you know, I think basic and logical questions when we encounter numbers, such as, are they plausible? Where did they come from? Here's one. Do you recall hearing the claim that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate?
I do, yeah.
Now, it turns out that's true. 4 out of 5 dentists do recommend Colgate. But when I hear a claim like that, there's a bunch of questions I would want to know more about this. For one thing, who are these dentists? Are they dentists who still have their licenses? Are they on the Colgate payroll? And did they really ask just 5, or did they ask 500 and, you know, 400 of them? And what about this fifth dentist? What's the fifth dentist recommending? But you can go deeper than that. And Colgate was actually sued for this claim because I think in the popular mind, and this is a lapse of critical thinking on our part, and it's not Colgate's fault, but I think they exploited it. In our mind, when we hear that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate, we complete the phrase with, to the exclusion of other toothpastes. And that's not at all what was going on. So when I encounter a statistic or a number, what I am hoping the journalist will tell me is more about how the number was arrived at. And in the Colgate case, the dentists were simply asked to list as many toothpastes as they wanted to that they would recommend. And so now you've got them recommending Colgate, but they're also recommending Gleam and Aquafresh and AIM and Crest and all the rest, Arm & Hammer. So Colgate lost the suit, and they can no longer make the claim.
And, yeah, that it's true from a particular perspective, and it sounds as though you had to do a little legwork to arrive at the data that you found about the 4 out of 5 dentist claim. So is that part of it, that we do have to maybe accept that we have to do sometimes a little homework?
I'm afraid so. The good news here is that the kind of homework we need to do doesn't take long. And when you consider how much time we save by having this great thing called the Internet, which just delivers any fact we want, you know, to our pocket within a minute, all the time we're saving by not having to trudge to a library or go to some far-flung archive, we can invest in trying to figure out whether the Internet is giving us information that's true or not. So, I mean, it's just a different way to use the time. You know, there's another thing about that dentist's claim, if I'm not drilling down too hard on this.
No, go ahead.
You see what I did there, drilling down?
Well done.
I have a particular beef about pseudo-experts, people who are not really expert in the thing they're pontificating about. And I don't know about you, but I've been going to a dentist my whole life, and my dentist has never asked me what toothpaste I use. And there's always somebody in the chair in the room next to me, and I've never heard him asking the other people. I'm not sure that a dentist is the appropriate expert. Wow. I think that what you need is a medical researcher who randomly assigns toothpastes to people, different toothpastes, and then follows them for a few years and see who's got the better oral health outcomes. That's who you should be asking. And there are studies done, you know, by medical researchers, but that's not what Colgate cited, is it?
No, they didn't. I think also that people, I mean, you trust the person who is in that position of power. You know, as we kind of wrap up to get to calls, though, I mean, how do you evaluate an expert, Daniel? If it's not a dentist, which seems obvious, how do you go about evaluating these other experts?
Well, I would say it doesn't take that much. It just takes a little bit of independent thought. Just take a breath and think: is a dentist really the right expert? Or in any case, you know, like with climate change. A number of the scientists who were voicing opinions about it, for or against, are not climatologists. They're not trained in climate science. You've got people who are electrical engineers or geneticists, and, you know, it's not their field. You know, if you need heart surgery, you don't go to a podiatrist. We understand some of this. The rest of it's just a bit of common sense, I would say.
We're talking with Daniel Levitin right now about his new book, Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's getting harder and harder to separate truth from lies with all the claims that maybe you see online? Have you given up, or do you have suggestions on how you sort things out successfully, or questions for our guest? Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Daniel Levitin is with us. He's a neuroscientist, and his new book is called Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. How do you try to sort out the truth from the lies as you look at social media, you follow the news, or when you listen to a politician? And what questions do you have for our guest? Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Bruce joining us in Madison. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Yeah, I was listening to the show, and I really like what I heard so far, but I've said for a long time now, many years, that people have opinions, and they assume the premises that that's the truth, whereas it's just an opinion. There's some opinions are not based in fact. They're just, you know, kind of like if you like a movie or not, but they kind of slide over to things about actual, you know, like global warming. You know, everybody has an opinion, but that doesn't make it true or false.
Right, Bruce. Go ahead, Daniel.
I really like this distinction you're making, Bruce. And I remember back to being in elementary school, I was part of the group of kids that they experimented with what they called the new math, if that rings any bells for listeners. And it tells you that I'm about 60 years old, too. But one of the things I remember in elementary school is they would give us statements, and we would have to say, is that opinion or fact? And, you know, it was rapid fire, and this went on for months. And I agree with the caller, Bruce, that we've gotten to a point where we don't make that distinction as readily, and it sometimes hijacks our thought process. As the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan quipped, and I think it's absolutely true, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you aren't entitled to your own facts.
And I think what Bruce is getting at, too, is that when something is a belief that we hold very dear to our heart, or maybe it's part of our core identity, you can throw as many facts as you want, and they're all going to bounce right off.
That's a whole other issue, Veronica, and it's a vexing one, because somebody who's made up their mind emotionally about something, as you just so insightfully pointed out, is not going to be tipped from their position by a rational argument. And that's where we can run into a lot of trouble as a society, you know, in the political process, trying to make some headway and find solutions to the problems that face us.
Well, Bruce, thanks a lot for the call and for bringing that up. And we go next to Tim in Appleton. Tim, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm going to be very politically incorrect here and mention something I've never heard in this discussion. And I was a reading specialist for 35 years, taught in high school. Maybe, just maybe, there are an awful lot of people who just are not intelligent enough to do any reasoning.
And that's a pretty controversial thing to say. And Daniel, what do you say to that as an educator?
Well, there's some data on this, fortunately. A group of researchers, cognition researchers, have come up with something called the rationality quotient, or RQ. And it runs alongside the IQ, the intelligence quotient. And it turns out that, you know, there is a way to rate a person's rationality. And it turns out that the rationality quotient is not at all related to the IQ, that people who are very high in IQ can have a low RQ and vice versa. And I've devoted my life to education, and I can tell you one of the great things about it is that it's equal opportunity. It's not the case that only the smart kids learn things in a classroom. Kids all along that axis are capable of learning things if they've got good teachers.
So in other words, rationality can be taught.
I believe, yes. I believe that rationality can be taught. I've seen it. That's what science education and legal education and journalism education is about, isn't it?
Well, thank you for that call. And now we're going to go to Nancy in Sussex. Nancy, hello.
Hi. Hi. I'm a reading teacher, and one of the things that I have found is I have children that are able to read but not understand what they read. They're not able to infer. They're not able to really comprehend what the words and things that they're saying mean. There are absolute truths, and there are truths that go beyond reason that can be proven. But what I think happens is people distort those truths based on their own comprehension and their own views versus what's real on the page and what it's meant to be. So I think sometimes the distortion comes from people's own personal views and not necessarily the fact that is told by a story and the way in which you infer its meaning and understand what it's supposed to be.
Nancy, can I ask how old the children are that you're working with?
I work with a range of children from kindergarten to high school. And what I find is that for many children, critical thinking comes at the point of inferring. In other words, they can read information. They have to have enough background and real information to be able to figure out if what they're reading is real or not. And I find that there are many times where children can read all the words and they're fluent and able to do what they're supposed to do, but yet when you ask them a question about what it was about, the theme, the idea, many times they can't tell you. So the truth comes in that fact that some people can really understand what they read and are told, and some people can infer what all the other pieces are that come into the meaning of what is being said or read.
Nancy, thank you for that. And Daniel, do you agree? Do we need some kind of baseline knowledge to make inferences and grasp more complex reasoning processes?
I think we learn to inference by example, by parents and teachers who model it for us, public figures. And I think we learn through education, through being taught how to inference, by being taught to make simple inferences and then more and more complex ones. Again, that's really what law school is about. And for those of us who have been following the federal court judge decisions that have relating to President Trump's various executive orders, the interesting thing is that from my perspective, I'm saying this as a citizen, not as a neuroscientist. I'm not testifying as an expert on the political process, but it seems to me the judges are just looking at the evidence. They don't have a political agenda, and in some cases they're finding that the evidence is lacking. And I think this is a triumph of a system that's working the way it was supposed to work. An independent judiciary weighs the evidence dispassionately. They are not making any inferences. They're making deductions based on the data that's in front of them.
Nancy, thank you for that call. And Daniel, I want to ask you about the critical thinking piece of it. Now, it sounds like you think that this is something we can learn at any age. We don't have to just get it in school. That would be helpful. What are some concrete steps that we can take right now, today, to get to where you're talking about?
Well, I mean, this is why I wrote the book. I don't think that my book is the only book that does this. There are other good books like Charles Wieland's Naked Statistics. There's a good book called Counter Knowledge. There's the old book from the 1950s called How to Lie with Statistics. You can probably pick that up for a dollar at the used bookstore. I'm not here to sell books. That seems kind of trivial compared to the larger message of getting people on board. But I did write the book to put all these ideas in one place, and one of them is plausibility. Is a claim plausible? Hillary Clinton doing a risky thing like operating a child sex slave ring just does not seem plausible. Or here's another one. It was claimed that in the 35 years since California stopped enforcing marijuana laws, the number of marijuana smokers in that state doubled every year. Now, you don't have to spend more than about 15 seconds and just do a quick calculation to realize that if you double, if you start with one marijuana smoker 35 years ago and you double the number one 35 times, you end up with 17 billion, which is more than the population of the Earth. So the claim isn't plausible. And you can dispense with a lot of stuff as nonsense if, you know, very early on in the process if you find it's not plausible.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Veronica.
That was neuroscientist Daniel Levitin. He is a fellow at the University of California, Berkeley, a distinguished faculty fellow, I should say. And we've been talking about his latest book. It's called Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. And you can let us know how you get that done, how you think critically, what's worked for you, where you go to find trusted sources, to fact check things. Let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page.